Swayam rupa kadamayam dadati swapadantikam vandeham shigro shiyuta parakamalam shigrom vaishnavamscha shirupam sagrajatam sahagana raganatam vitam tam sajivam sadvaitam savadhutam prajna saitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Visakhan Zvitanscha Hey Krishna Karna Sindho Dinabandho Jagadpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchena Gorangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Prishubhanu Sita Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vanchakapa Trubhyascha Kripa Sinubhyevacha Patidanam Pavanevyo Vaishnavevyo Namo Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shadvaita Gadadhar Shivasati Gaur Bhaktivrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate
Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate
Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 11, Text Number 23. Nisha,
Nisha
Avasane,
Avasane
Arabdha,
Arabdha
Loka,
Loka
Kalpa
Anuvartate
Yadvat
Dinam
Bhagavataha
Manun
Bunjan
Chatu
Dasha
Nishavasana
Arabdao
Loka
Kalpo
Nuvartate
Yavadinam
Bhagavato
Manun
Bunjan
Saturdasha
Nisha
Vasana
Arabdo
Loka Kalpa Nuvartate
Yavadinam
Bhagavato
Manun
Bunjan
Saturdasha
Nisha.
What does that mean? We had that yesterday. Loud. Loudly? What does it mean? Can't hear you.
Night.
Night, right. Everyone repeat, night.
Night.
What's the word for night in Sanskrit?
Nisha.
And what does Nisha mean? Avasane.
Avasane.
Termination.
Termination.
Arabda.
Arabda.
Beginning from.
Beginning from.
Loka kalpa.
Loka kalpa.
Further creation of the three worlds.
Further creation of the three worlds.
Anuvartate.
Anuvartate.
What does that mean? Yeyatamam prapadyante. Yad. Yadyadacharya shrestas tat tad evetirojanaha siyat pramanam krute lokas tad anuvartate. Yes. Following. Yavat. Until. Dinam. What does that mean?
Day.
Day, yes. The daytime. Can't hear you.
Daytime.
Not everyone participated. Once more.
Daytime.
Bhagavataha.
Bhagavataha.
Of the Lord.
Of the Lord.
Brahma.
Brahma.
Manun. The Manus.
The Manus.
Bhunjan.
Existing through.
Chatu. Dasha. How much is Chatur Dasha? How much is that?
14.
Yes. Translation and a very small purport by Srila Prabhupada. After the end of Brahma's night, the creation of the three worlds begins again in the daytime of Brahma, and they continue to exist through the life durations of 14 consecutive Manus, or fathers of mankind. So what did I just read? Yes.
After the day of Brahma, the night, it continues to exist, 14 consecutive Manus.
What is that? Could you say that again? What happens after the night? And then, yeah, that's right. After the night comes, no one seems to, no one's even sure about that. Let's try it again. After the night comes, I can't hear you. Krishnamayi. After the night comes, you don't know what comes after the night?
Day.
Are you sure? After the night comes day. What's the word for day in Sanskrit? Shamasundar?
Dinam.
Yes. So after the end of Brahma's night, the creation of the three worlds begins again in the dash of Brahma. What's the word? Yes. Daytime, yes. And they continue to exist through the life durations of 14 consecutive Manus, or fathers of mankind. So Prabhupada's purport, at the end of the life of each Manu, there are shorter dissolutions also. Per 24. So, swam swam kalam anora bhunkte sadikam yeka sap titim. Translation, each and every Manu enjoys a life of a little more than 71 sets of four millenniums. Purport, the duration of the life of a Manu comprises 71 sets of four millenniums as described in the Vishnu Purana. The duration of life of one Manu is about 852,000 years in the calculation of the demigods, or in the calculation of human beings, 306,720,000 years. Not bad. Text 25. Manvatareshu manavas tadvangsha rishayasura bhavanti chaiva yugapat sureshas chanu ye chatan. After the dissolution of each and every manu, the next manu comes in order along with his descendants who rule over the different planets. But the seven famous sages and demigods like Indra and their followers such as the Gandharvas all appear simultaneously with Manu. Purport. There are 14 Manus in one day of Brahma, and each of them has different descendants. Text 26. Esha Dainandina Sargo Brahma Srilokya Vartana Tirandri Priti Pitri Devanam Sambhavo Yatra Karmabhi. In the creation during Brahma's day, the three planetary systems, Swarga, Marti, and Patala, revolve, and the inhabitants, including the lower animals, human beings, demigods, pithas, appear and disappear in terms of their fruit of activities. Manvatareshu Bhagavan Bibrat Satvam Sa Morti Bhi Man Vadi Bir Aidam Shvishvam Avat Yudita Parusha. In each and every change of Manu, the Supreme Personality of Godhead appears by manifesting his internal potency in different incarnations as Manu and others. Thus he maintains the universe by discovered power. Tamo matram upadaya prati samruda vikrama kalena nugata shesha aste tushnim dinatyaye. At the end of the day, under the insignificant portion of the mode of darkness, the powerful manifestations of the universe merges in the darkness of night. By the influence of eternal time, the innumerable living entities remain merged in that dissolution, and everything is silent. Please repeat. At the end of the day, under the insignificant portion of the mode of darkness, the powerful manifestation of the universe merges in the darkness of night. By the influence of eternal time, the innumerable living entities remain merged in that dissolution. And everything is silent. So if there's too much noise, you want some peace, just wait. You'll get plenty of it soon. For a long time. Purport. This verse is an explanation of the night of Brahma, which is the effect of the influence of time in touch with an insignificant portion of the mode's material nature in darkness. The dissolution of the three worlds is affected by the incarnation of darkness, Rudra, represented by the fire of eternal time, which blazes over the three worlds. These three worlds are known as Bhuva and Swa, Patala, Martya, and Swarga. Innumerable living entities merge into that dissolution, which appears to be the dropping of the curtain of the scene of the Supreme Lord's energy, and so everything becomes silent. In the Bhagavatam, it explains that we're going to kick out everything that's unimportant and simply explain the very essence of the philosophy of Krishna consciousness. But it seems like in the first nine cantos, there's a lot of different subject matters that are being explained. So why do you think these subject matters are being explained about time? What does time have to do with Krishna? Is it trying to make us afraid? Is all this talk about dissolutions, annihilations, darkness, merging, is it supposed to make us afraid? Richie?
Yes.
How many think it's supposed to make us afraid? How many are not afraid? How many are, can't understand anything I'm saying? How many are just numb by fear and they can't raise their hand? Yes, we're supposed to become afraid, but we don't become afraid. That's the problem. We couldn't care less. Because why? Why don't we care less? Jagat Chakshus. Yes, that's an easy way out. That's it. We already know that. Yes.
Because we think we're eternal in this body.
Probably, yeah. We don't really believe it. We don't believe we're going to be annihilated. We're going to be here forever. We got big plans going on. And these plans stretch out way beyond thousands of years. We don't believe that this universe is going to be annihilated. We don't believe that even our body is going to be annihilated. In other words, we're quite skeptical when we hear about these vast figures, hundreds of millions of years, people are living, and even they get merged into the ocean of devastation. Just imagine it was your 300 millionth birthday. Imagine there was a big cake about the size of the city of Houston, and they spent 3 years putting the candles on. And they asked you to blow them out for your birthday, and that took you a year. And then you were informed that you only have 2 years left to live. There's going to be a big flood, everyone's going to be killed, and you're going to be killed too. After your 306 millionth birthday, how would you feel? Say, wait a second. If I live this long, why can't I live another 306 million years? You'd be quite disappointed, right? Probably get attached to a few things. You know, I've had this house for the last 30 million years. How can I leave it? They probably get a little attached. It's exactly the house I wanted. I worked 170 million years to get it. And now you're taking it all away. You get even more attached. But we don't believe it because for many different reasons. So when we hear this, it's just like hearing a fairy tale for most of us. So if we think that this is a fairy tale, what to speak of Krishna's pastimes? If we can't, the things that are right before us, like death, has anyone ever seen anything die? I'm sure we've seen a few things die. So we have some faith that things do die, although we may not believe that we're going to leave our bodies. So this is talking about things that are right before, right within our experience. So what to speak of the things like, how many of us really have deep faith that there is a mountain which is 800,000 miles high? Mount Everest is supposed to be how many miles high? It's probably like 5 miles high. Maybe 5 miles. So what about a mountain that's 800,000 miles high? Take a long time to reach it. It would be a real challenge, wouldn't it? And it's made out of gold. And one day the demigods and the demons, they try to pick it up. Actually, that was Meru. They picked it up and carried it to the ocean of milk. You still following? And it was so heavy they dropped it on themselves. How's that for a suicide pack? And they all got crushed. And then Lord Vishnu came riding on the back of Garuda and pick them up and put them all back together again. And then he took Garuda, took the mountain, Meru, put it on his back, and flew all the demigods in the mountain to the ocean of milk. How does that sound? You all still have faith? You're all still following? Sure, that's right. Could have made a documentary out of it. And then he put it down in the ocean milk, and it sank into the ocean milk, and he came as Lord Tortoise in order to scratch an itch on his back. You ever have an itch on your back? Matter of fact, imagine if you had such a big itch, you had to put a mountain 800,000 miles high made out of gold on your back to scratch it. And you had all the demigods and demons in the universe churning the ocean milk and scratching your back. I scratch your back, you scratch mine. So this enters into a realm that it's more or less like a fairy tale to us. As a matter of fact, according to most of our realizations, practically everything in the Bhagavatam is like a fairy tale. And what to speak, and then we come to the 10th canto, and we find out that Krishna, he's dancing for 3,400,000 years, times 1,000, which is 3,400,000,000 years, he's dancing with the gopis at night. And he's not only doing that, but he's dancing in between every gopi. And there's 1 billion gopis. So how far does that stretch our faith? In other words, what is actual faith? Why is it that we listen to it very carefully, we kind of accept it somewhere in our consciousness, but we don't really have full faith in it? In other words, why is it that we don't have faith? Because we have no experience of it. Do you have anyone here have experience of someone dividing themselves up twice? Can anyone do that here? No. Has anyone ever seen anything like that? You've seen that? What's that?
Earthworm.
An earthworm. But are they the same person, both earthworms? No. It's probably two souls. But the same person in two bodies. Has anyone ever seen that? Has anyone ever seen anything like that within our experience? Yes, we have that experience. Everyone has that experience. Just like right now we're in our body, but we can think about something else. We can start thinking about Vrindavan and Radhakund, how Radhakund and Shyamakund are there, and there's a area which is in between Radhakund and Shyamakund. And simultaneously, we can imagine that people are approaching us with tilak. If you've ever been in Radhakund or Shyamakund, they're trying to sell you tilak, and you're screaming at them, get lost. So, we've divided ourselves up. Here I am, I'm speaking very calmly, and in my mind I'm saying, get lost! So isn't there two persons? Are my two different persons acting simultaneously? What's that?
Siddhadeha.
No, it's not my Siddhadeha. It's my mind. It's my mind which is doing it. But my mind's also working through this gross body. That's why it's manifesting activities. So I've divided myself into two different persons. One person seems to be nice and calm, and the other one's screaming at some little Brajavasis trying to sell me tilak. I always wanted to do that anyhow, because if you scream at them, then they get even more nasty at you. So now I divide myself into two. Isn't that a kind of division of our identity into two? No? Now, since we're working with the soul is working with the gross body, because the soul is actually not doing anything, it's just working with the gross body. So it's conceivable that if there was another gross body that my mind was powerful enough to work through, I could do two things simultaneously. So what to speak of the Supreme Person? He could do so many things simultaneously. Anyhow, there's a lot of these things within the realm of our experience. Just like, for instance, to conceive of a mountain 800,000 miles high is almost inconceivable to us. Well, how big would a mountain have to be in comparison to an ant to be 800,000 miles high? Is it possible, say one of these pillars, and you had an ant walking there, how big would the pillar appear to the ant? Pretty high, like a skyscraper. What to speak of a small hill, he'd look at it like a big mountain, like Everest. So it's relative. So what happens if we found out that we were just ants in comparison to another species of life? Is that possible? So for them, maybe this pillar is just like a normal pillar, and for us, it's just like the Mount Everest. There was a book called Gulliver's Travels, and Gulliver was traveling, and he came to, I think the first one he came to was persons who were leopard, what were they called? What's that? Say that again.
I think they were called
Lilliputians. So they were very tiny. So he was a big giant. As a matter of fact, he was in the water, and he gathered, all these boats were attacking him, all these big ships were attacking him. But for him, they were just like little play ships, like little toy ships. And he just gathered them all together and defeated the army, the navy of the other kingdom. And he became a big hero, because he was a big giant. But then he went to another place, and he was just like a little puppy dog, and everyone else was big giants. He was even smaller than that. So in one place he was a giant, and the other place he was completely insignificant, like a little ant somewhere. So isn't that possible? Yes? No one wants to say anything. Yes?
Yes.
Janet? Jane? Jane? Yes?
Yes.
Everyone say yes?
Yes.
Yes. Let's, all right, everyone who didn't say yes, say no. So why isn't it possible? Have we explored the whole universe? Do we actually know what's going on? Have the scientists actually sent rockets up and explored Brahmaloka? Do we actually believe that the scientists went to the moon? No. Do you believe the scientists went to the moon?
No.
No. Now, how much information does anyone actually have on this planet? How much knowledge do our big scientists have? If you ask the scientists, what's the difference between a living body and a dead body, what will they say? What do you think, Shyamasundar, what do you think the scientists will say? The Nobel Prize winner, physicists, if you ask them, what is the difference between a living body and a dead body? What will they say? Why? They don't know. So if a person doesn't know, you have another answer?
They would say something like self-generated neural activity.
What is that self-generated neural activity?
Meaning that without the help of external objects, the brain is throwing electrical charges around by itself.
That, does that mean that you're alive or dead?
That means that they would say that means you're alive.
So if there's external objects and you stay alive?
What's that?
So what makes you alive?
Without external objects, the brain is firing, your lungs.
So without, so if you take away everything, we'll live forever.
No, without the help, without the aid of external objects.
What objects? So without, so you mean you don't need the external objects to make your brain fire?
Right. That would be the definition of the difference between a living body and a dead body.
So as long as you don't need external objects to make your brain fire, then you're alive.
Okay.
Is that all right?
That sounds correct.
So when you die, what's the difference? Why do you die then?
Your brain stops firing.
Why? Gives up what? What does it give up? In other words, how do you know it gives up? In other words, the big scientists who are said to know everything, have so much information, so much education, they don't even know what the difference between a living body and a dead body is. So how much knowledge do they have? So what is the difference between a living body and a dead body, Gopal?
Well, the difference between living and dead is the presence or absence of the spirit soul.
How do we know that? Who's the soul? Do you know any souls? Do you have experience of any souls? You have no experience of a soul. Now, who are you?
Something other than this body.
What are you? Don't be embarrassed. Yes, we're the soul. We're the person who's conscious. Has anyone ever noticed that they're conscious? That's within everyone's experience, right? That there's a person inside this body who's conscious. That's who we are. It's not your father. It's not your mother. Because if you say there's more than one person conscious in your body, that may be a fact, that may be one of your problems too. But generally speaking, when we're the person who's conscious of the body, we're the person who's conscious of the things outside of the body, and the body is alive as long as the conscious soul is there. And what happens when the conscious soul leaves the body? What happens to the body? Then it appears to be dead. Yes? All these really profound philosophical questions we're throwing out there. The body appears to be dead, right? Let's hear it.
Yes.
But it was always dead. Only due to the presence of the soul does it appear to be alive. So, if you can't see the soul, for instance, if the scientist came and with a microscope opened your heart up, because we say that the soul is in the heart, and took the most high-powered microscope, looked into your heart, and said, "You're not there. Sorry, you're not there." Would we believe them? The scientists are always right, right? They're the authorities. They said, "I'm not there. I couldn't possibly be there. I don't exist." Oh, how unfortunate I am. The scientists have discovered I don't exist. Would you believe them?
No.
No one's really sure. So why do we have such faith in the scientists? They don't even know that we exist. Matter of fact, the scientist doesn't even know that they exist. They don't even know that they exist, what to speak of anyone else existing. So how much knowledge do they have? What is the quality of their knowledge? In other words, why do we give the scientists credit? Because they can invent machines. And what can these machines do? What is the best thing that machines can do? They, for instance, they can keep your heart pumping for a little bit, seemingly a little longer. They can give you information on a radio or a television coming from thousands of miles away. So they can do certain things. They can give us perception of the material world in different ways. But what is the whole idea? What is the actual focus on? It's the self. They're trying to give enjoyment to ourselves, the soul within the body. But if they don't even know who the soul is, what is the value? Just like, for instance, if I was riding in a car and I thought I was the car. What is the word in Sanskrit for identifying with the car? Yes.
Ahamkar.
I am the car. So we're identified with the car, and then you go to the gas station and you ask them, can you please put some gasoline into the car? And they do that. And you say, oh, I'm also hungry. Can you give me some gasoline too? So that's a mistake, isn't it? Now they've taken care of your car by giving you gasoline, but is that what you want? Is that what you need? So is what's more important? Say you had $5. You could spend it on a sandwich because you're starving to death, or your car is out of gas. Where would you put your $5? Into the gas tank with oil, or buy a sandwich, a samosa for $5? Where would you spend your money?
Samosa.
You'd spend it on the car and starve to death. You're very kind.
Why would you take me to the place that I can buy something?
But you only have $5. So, the scientists, we certainly give them credit for learning how to put fuel into the car. But what about for the actual driver of the car? What are they doing for the driver, the self? Jai Radhe Shyam.
Nothing.
So, is that which is more valuable, the car or the driver? Guru Bhakti Devi Das. Oh, she's not here. Yes. Everyone agree?
Yeah.
One person.
Yes.
Once again.
Yes.
So here it's describing something beyond our experience. But then again, even our best authorities that we have, that we rely upon outside ourselves, the scientists, their own experience is very limited. They don't even know about the soul. What to speak of the super soul? What to speak of what's actually going on other planets? And the other interesting thing is that most of our so-called leaders, they're cheaters. They brought us the movie, the motion picture of the man landing on a planet. One big leap for man, and one, what is that? One small step.
Yeah.
Kind. But how much did that movie cost? Something like $40 billion for a movie. And who paid for it? Because we didn't pay any taxes. But there were people paid for a $40 billion movie. Which right now wouldn't even draw, you know, even 500 people wouldn't even go and see it. It's such so rinky dink. Just imagine if they actually had a real movie of people landing, how exciting it would have been. But now you look back at it, if anyone has seen the moon landing, and you see it's just like a completely rinky dink movie.
They said that they lost all the movies and all the information they have.
They lost it all. They only spent $40 billion on it. They couldn't afford to make it. They spent so much money on the film, they couldn't make a copy of it. And everyone's supposed to believe it. So not only we believe what they're saying, but we believe that they actually know where life comes from. They believe that ultimately we don't even the people, they don't exist, no one really exists, and we're supposed to accept these as learned persons because they went to college and they got their degrees. So, as Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakura said, that modern education means to turn a normal person into an ass. So is that very harsh words? Is he just being insulting? Or is it actually a fact? Yeah, because an ass also believes that he's holding only the body and nothing beyond that. But a human being, person with some knowledge, some real knowledge, understands that there's a conscious person within the body. That's ourselves. If we don't believe in ourselves that we exist, that we're conscious, that there's a difference between what we're conscious of, namely the material world, and the soul who's conscious, then what is the quality of our knowledge? It's all ignorance. Therefore, when we're hearing the Bhagavatam, we don't have to blindly accept it, but we don't have to blindly reject it either, simply because it's not within the realm of our experience or the realm of our authorities we accept, who supposedly have a greater realm of knowledge beyond what we have, namely the modern scientists. So we don't have to blindly accept, nor do we have to rely upon so-called scientists and then blindly reject it. It's not talent, not be in line with their level of knowledge, and they're supposed to have a superior level of knowledge than we have. But actually, they're just distributing, for the most part, ignorance. So we'll stop there. Thank you. Any questions? Yes.
On this Earth planet, we know the difference between night and day because of the circulations of the sun. But for the purpose of Brahma, what does he determine night and day as?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, when he looks at his watch.
How does he set his watch?
By the sun. Because for us, the sun is revolving around what's known as, well, I guess it's Bhumandala. It's on the chariot. It's ringed up to the mountains which surround Bhumandala. So the sun rides on his chariot. So we're looking at it, and it takes him 12 hours to go halfway around. But somehow or another, I can't remember exactly how it works out. But in other parts of the universe where the planets are differently arranged, it takes them not 12 hours to go around, it takes them 6 months to see the other side of the sun. Because they have a different perspective on it. I guess you can work it out mathematically. In other words, here's the Earth and it's going around and it takes 12 hours. But here, somehow or another, outside that circle that the sun's going around, it takes a different perspective. It takes them 6 months to see the other side of the sun. And then in Brahmaloka, I don't think that they're relying on the sun for day and night. They're in a completely different category. How exactly that works out, I don't really know. Does anyone have any information on that? How Brahmaloka is viewing the sun? Oh, the other interesting thing that I just remembered is not, see, we're in a particular position where we're also moving, well, we're circulating, the sun and the planets are circulating, but they're circulating together in a bigger circle. So when they all circulate together, it appears that one is going very fast, but in terms, say something's going around very fast, but in relationship to something outside the system, it appears to be practically stationary, which is going around here. But this is going around together in a much bigger... Is that clear? In other words, the sun, the moon, Venus, all of them, all these planetary systems, they're circulating in a big orbit. And that orbit is going around something else. So although the sun appears to be going round and round and round, but in relationship to this planet outside, it's just practically in the same place all the time. But only when it goes around, when this whole thing goes around, and this planet is right there, then it says, oh, now we're on the other side. So that may take 6 months, it may take 60 million years. Depends. There may be something with this whole thing circulating around. Is that clear? Did you get it, Krishnamayi? No. Because it circles within circles. Say this book was, example of these books. Say this book was here, and this is going around. But what happens if this book is going around also, and there's something outside here who's watching the thing going around, and until it goes all the way around to the other side of this object here, then this is all considered day for them. Because they're just seeing the sun. But for us, it's night and day. Is that clear? So it circles within orbits, within orbits. And some of them are bigger orbits, and some are little orbits. So the sun, for some places, which is also circulating in an orbit, along with the planets, may take much longer to go, you know, for something outside this particular system of orbits, and then finally goes around and considered 6 months. Is that clear? Yes.
You were mentioning about the scientists, how they say that we don't exist, you don't exist, I don't exist. So what do they define as our experience?
They don't. They don't even deal with it. It's beyond their realm. They say it's all this. They don't believe in the soul. Therefore, they go up to the level of usually the mind, cognitive perception. They believe everything is, for the most part, conditioned reflex. We're just responding. There's a stimuli, and then there is a response. And it's all automatic, just like a dog. So that's the scientist. There may be some realm of philosophers or psychiatrists or psychologists who enter into the realm of free will, seemingly, and that's called proactive. That in between the stimuli, there is some opportunity to determine what the response will be based upon available information. That you don't automatically respond as soon as there's stimuli. If you have proper knowledge, you may make choices. So that's called proactive. In other words, there's a person making a choice. But the scientists, they don't deal with that. They deal with what's called the laws of nature. That if you throw a ball up under certain circumstances, by the laws of gravity, it falls down. And if it doesn't fall down under certain circumstances, then you come up with another law, quantum mechanics, to explain the new phenomena, why it didn't fall down. But they never bring in consciousness into the equation, most scientists. Sometimes they do, but they're considered to be metaphysicists, a different realm. Yes?
Well, in the small book, The Easy Journey to the Planets, Prabhupada's talking about anti-matter, the anti-proton.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about
it. Protons are against the other protons, they're called antiprotons.
So, would they consider that to be consciousness? Or just...
No, Prabhupada was just using it because he had read some article by a scientist in Russia who was talking about antimatter. The whole speculation about there is black holes, and the black holes, all the matter enters into the black hole and disappears somewhere. So he read about that. There's matter and antimatter and all the speculation. So he utilized that analogy, that idea, and said, yes, there's matter and then there's spirit, which is antimatter. But I'm sure that the scientist, the Russian scientist that wrote the article, was not explaining matter and antimatter in the same way the Prabhupada did. The Prabhupada took that up in order to show that we're also scientific. But our conception is different from the scientist's conception of matter and antimatter.
They're putting consciousness
in the equation. We're putting soul as antimatter and matter and but it's not really like that. Probably just writing to utilize a scientific, but to present ourselves as scientific, which we actually are. In other words, use the scientific terminology to explain our philosophy. So the people who have a scientific bent of mind will be able to accept it more easily, that yes, they're also scientifically minded. So you utilize, as Prabhupada said, you use, take a nutcracker or something to crack your teeth with. That sounds pretty horrible, doesn't it? But you take someone's, their own weapons, whatever it is, and use it against them. So the scientists have invented this terminology that it appears very learned and erudite, which means absolutely nothing. It's just a bunch of jugglery words. And we use the same jugglery words to present Krishna consciousness, so it becomes more easily acceptable by people who've been trained up in the scientific terminology. Of course, most scientists will read that book and say the Prabhupada was unfair, it was unethical utilizing the terminology of the scientists, present antimatter, which is just beyond our experience and therefore not within their scientific realm of explanation. But Prabhupada didn't care about such protests. Anything else? Yes. Yeah, it's pretty hard to go to sleep. You got to get real tired and go to sleep on the sun plant. But the advantage of is it's nice and warm there. If you're a vata by constitution, and you really need some heat, there's no better place to live. No, anything here, if it's so hot all the time there, then even if it drops a few degrees, everyone puts on their winter coat. Because everything is relative in the material world. Even if it seems so bright there, but everyone has a body made of fire, so probably their night is everything gets, they dim down the sun planet a little bit, and everyone goes to sleep. It's all relative. In the middle of the ocean, they discovered that there were living entities living in the fire that was coming up from the bottom of the ocean, which was 6,000 centimeters hot, centigrade. And they found, when they took the living entities out of that fire and they got into an environment which is a few hundred degrees less, they all start to die from the cold. So for them, 6,000 centigrade was normal temperature, and a little less than that was freezing.
6,000?
Fahrenheit, centigrade.
6,000.
Degrees, centigrade. Something like that, I can't remember the exact number, but anything, even a few hundred degrees less was freezing for the living entities there. So we could not live in such a high temperature, we can't even conceive of it, we'd immediately get burnt, but they were living happily there. So it's all relative. If you had a body which could live on the sun planet, you get used to it. You wouldn't even notice the heat, practically speaking. Of course it would be warm, but you wouldn't notice it. But if you just go to a place in the sun planet, a few degrees colder, then you actually feel cool in relation to the intense heat in the sun planet. A little place there, which is a little darker, And you actually feel it was like night, relatively speaking. Yes.
In Iraq, they're wearing all these military outfits all day long. It's 130 degrees. And at night, it drops down to 90. And everybody puts on their coats and their gloves and they're freezing. At 90, apparently.
Yeah, cold. Okay, thank you very much. Grandhara Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai, Gaur Premanande Hari Bol.